Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Again, good morning, everyone. Today's sutta is on the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. This is one of the what are considered the three cardinal discourses of the Buddha, meaning the most important, most significant, or overarching. We know that that's partly true. Paticca Samuppada and the Satipatthana Sutta would be one of those two, what I like to call primary suttas. Rama and I had a discussion on the use of that terminology. The Buddha's first discourse was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the sutta establishing, for the first and only time in human history, the Four Noble Truths as a complete description of humanity. And upon, you remember the sutta, upon hearing that sutta, Khandana awakened. He said that all conditioned things that arise will pass away. And the Buddha declared, you are now Anakandana, the one who understands. In that one sentence, Khandana was expressing his complete understanding of what the Buddha was teaching, and the Buddha understood that. Of course, it's a very broad understanding, but it relates directly to the three marks of existence, the misunderstanding of self in relation to its impermanent environment, resulting in suffering because of that conditioned thinking. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. The conditioned thing that we are addressing in the Buddha's Dhamma is the conditioning that we've placed on our view of self. And so that can be referred to as a wrong view or a right view. The essence of the Buddha's Dhamma is developing a right view of what constitutes a human being in relation to its environment and why a misunderstanding of that will always lead to stress and suffering and often to violence like we see today in the world. And then the third sutta was the fire discourse. And these three suttas we almost always taught on our retreats, not completely, but most of the time. And the fire discourse is also called the attachment to passion or the passion discourse. And so if you look at the first three cardinal discourses, the one Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta presents a broad and all-encompassing discourse of the Buddha's teaching. It's also a broad teaching on impermanence, the first mark of existence. This sutta, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, teaches the relationship of that not-self, how that not-self is formed out of ignorance. Next Tuesday's class will be on the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta, which is the Buddha's teaching on what actually is a self. So these two back-to-back form a very nice little package of the Buddha's teaching what is not a self in this sutta, and Tuesday we'll hear what the Buddha teaches as self. You'll notice the reference here is to the five clinging aggregates, which the Buddha established in his teachings as the explanation and a description of ongoing suffering rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, the five clinging aggregates. And every one of these is themselves a fabrication, and so the collective view of this, the concept of it, is of course fabricated. And that's what the Buddha is teaching. So, let me just read the sutta. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Benares in the deer park at Isipatthana. There he addressed a group of five now bhukkhas. These were, remember, this is the second discourse the Buddha gave. Khandana has now awakened. And so, and him and the other four original members of the Sangha were obviously discussing the ramifications of what the Buddha had just taught them. And at the and in the Sangha, the Buddha's hearing these discussions, and he's realizing that they're getting caught up on this notion of if ignorance arises, what is the manifesting agent of that ignorance, and where does it reside? In other words, well, if what you're saying is this self is rooted in ignorance, what is a self? But first, the Buddha needs to describe what the self isn't. So, there he addressed a group of now five bhikkhus. Bhikkhus means monks. Bhikkhus, form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to suffering, and one could have it be any form desired and be stress-free. What the Buddha is referring to is we don't have the ability to make any type of form. In other words, I can't make this form into a Maserati. This is the form of all humanity, a physical form. The problem resides in a fabrication and trying to make this form something that it's not, a fabrication. And so once I do that, once I attach a fabricated view to this form, I'm now living in that fabrication. This form is not self. The Buddha's reference to anatta was using a common term in a completely uncommon way. And so the common reference to anatta was rooted in the Vedas, the precursor to modern Hinduism. And in that reference, which was very common, anatta meant there's no such thing as a self. And it's more, I don't want to get into the deep, elaborate explanation that's attached to Hinduism, because that really doesn't relate to what the Buddha taught. The Buddha was using that term to say, even your view of the term is wrong. Anatta means wrong views of self, period. It means that I'm holding on to a fabrication. Let go of the views, because the views do not constitute a self. And that's what the Buddha is referring to. Your view of form does not constitute reality. It's not a self. Let go of the view. So again, and when we understand it that way, we get past the argument of, well, what is this thing then? It's just not a self. That's all we need to know as far as the Dhamma is concerned, and that becomes clear in this. Let me go back after that long explanation. Bhikkhu's form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to suffering, and one could have it be any form desired and be stress-free. Since form is not self, it leads to suffering. Meaning, because we believe in this form that's not really a self, it leads to suffering. Since form is not self, it leads to suffering. And none can have it be any form desired and be stress-free. That's the Buddha's reference to creating a speculative existence for this self, such as, I'm the world's greatest meditation teacher, the world's greatest baker, the world's greatest anything, or the world's worst anything, or any other imaginary existence of self, even if you might be a meditation teacher, and even if you might be the world's greatest meditation teacher like yours truly, it's a fabrication to believe so. And I'm just kidding. And it leads to stress, because now I have to live up to that, to the ideal, the ideology that I established myself, rather than just being a human being who teaches meditation or something else. That's the significant difference. When I create a fabricated view of self, I'm now living the not self existence, and it's always stress free. Bhikkhus, feeling is not self, as perceptions are not self, fabrications are not self, consciousness is not self. Those are the five clinging aggregates that the Buddha just covered. If these aggregates were self, they would not lead to suffering, and one could direct these aggregates as one wished. So there's such an important teaching there. If we recognize that any one of these aggregates that we're clinging to, the form aggregate, the feeling aggregate, the mental fabrication aggregate, or the consciousness aggregate, if we notice that any one of that clinging is causing distress for us, it's because we're attaching a wrong view to the aggregate. And it's a clear instruction and even a caution about paying attention to this right now. Pay attention to stress as stress arises, because that's where the key to liberation resides. Bhikkhus, how do you perceive this is for, how do you perceive this? Is form permanent or impermanent? The five replied, it's impermanent, venerable sir. Now, is what is impermanent painful or pleasant? They're painful. It's always painful, venerable sir. Now, what is impermanent? What is painful, since subject to change? Is this fit to be regarded as this is mine? This is I, this is myself. Of course it's not. And they replied, no, venerable sir. Remember the teachings to Bahia. Bahia awakened when the Buddha gave him that teaching. In you, there's no you here, there, or anywhere in between. Same thing. Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Are fabrications permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? All are impermanent, venerable sir. Except we have a feeling, and we insist that it's permanent, because and we do that, the obviousness of that is that we react to the feeling rather than understand, no matter what this feeling is, whether it's fear, sadness, joy, great self-aggrandizement over achievement, it's all impermanent and it's fleeting. So the Dhamma unites a mind and our body, and whatever feeling I'm feeling right now through right view is the appropriate feeling because it's rooted in right view, and I understand there's no need to cling to it because it's here. In other words, I don't need to keep fabricating it. Excuse me. I don't need to keep fabricating this feeling because if I'm present for it, now the feeling is real. I'm not attaching any fabricated judgment to it. I'm simply feeling life as life occurs without the need for that feeling or life to be any different than it is. That's liberation. As opposed to the prison of my own mind that when a feeling comes up, I need to either approve of it or disapprove of it and insist of a different feeling right now. And insisting that I feel different right here, right now is impossible. I'm literally beating the hell out of myself when I do that. Instead of understanding, this is my human understanding of what's occurring. When I heard I told myself I'm not going to do any reference to what's occurring in human, in current events. So how do I teach that? When I hear something sad, something really horrible, it's just a common occurrence, such as children getting shot. Again, no reference to what's occurring. This has been going on forever and ever. I feel sad when I hear it. You all feel sad when you hear it, don't you? But I don't go to the next step of, I got to find the shooter and shoot him myself. I must counter the hate that I'm feeling right now for what occurred to hate the person that caused the feeling, because I've lost my mind. But what I can do is understand how awful it is for violence to erupt, human-on-human violence to erupt every day of our lives, but understand where it came from, because then I don't have to lose my mind about it. I made a statement a while ago, and a few people didn't question me on it. They remarked on it, that if humans had the ability to really understand what was occurring in their life, the first time one human being harmed another, the shock to that human being would have been so strong that it never would have happened again in human history. But we did not learn from that, did we? And so since the beginning of human time, there's been human-on-human violence. Since the beginning of human time, there's been human and human compassion. That's part of being human. One is not wrong and one is not right. They're both part of being, of living in human condition. If we want to change the so-called negative aspects of life, the Buddha teaches we must understand why they arise. That makes sense, doesn't it? If I want to know why my head keeps hurting every time I bang it against a wall, I have to stop for a moment and look at what I'm doing. If I'm feeling outrage over what's occurring in the world, I have to stop a minute and look at what I'm perceiving here. That's what the Buddha teaches. This is called refined mindfulness or right mindfulness, seeing things clearly. Are all those things, are the five clinging aggregates permanent or impermanent? All are impermanent, Venerable Sir. Now, is what is impermanent, what is painful, since it is subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? No, Venerable Sir. The Buddha just presented what he described as the ongoing personal experience of suffering, the five clinging aggregates, and he clearly explained to them and got them to see by the question and answer, so important here, that no, the things that I've used to establish a self, these five clinging aggregates, and I should say to establish a self prone to suffering, is not really me. Think of the liberation in that teaching. All the views that I've had of myself that caused all the suffering for me, not for the world and not in the world, well, in the world, but not because of it, because of my perceptions, are rooted in ignorance. They're not really me. Simply put, I've made a mistake about my perceptions. And that's the most gentle way to put it. I simply made a mistake. And there's no one to blame for the mistake. I can go back and say, well, from the day I was born, nobody taught me Four Noble Truths. Well, nobody's taught Siddhartha Four Noble Truths either. But he took the time to sit down, put his mind back in his body, and look out on the world mindfully and say, this is what's occurring. All of my distress for the first 26 years, 35 years of my life, meaning Siddhartha's life, is because of my perceptions and my fabrications. It's not because of the people in the world or the governments of the world. It has nothing to do with it. It has to do with the way. And when I finally understood that, it took me quite a few years, and maybe I'm still unraveling it. But just the feeling of liberation by understanding, now I finally know how to live my life as a human being. And it wasn't easy. I had to let go of all of my beliefs that I built up for many, many years as a Buddhist practitioner, that I believed in, that I put years and years of effort in. That's what makes these things so hard. We have such a vested interest in the effort we put into creating our fabrications, whatever it is. And again, going back to that first time of human violence on human violence, you would think that a mind that is rooted in this suffering would have the wherewithal to recognize what it's doing for itself. But we don't, because of that most profound statement that the Buddha ever gave. From ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of suffering arises. And it's the nature of ignorance to ignore ignorance. It's in the word itself, isn't it? It's the root of ignorance. It's a manifestation of ignorance. Ignorance wouldn't arise without the intense personal desire to ignore something. And in this case, ignore who I am and the true nature of the world I live in. And the Buddha teaches exactly what that is. So bhikkhus, any kind of form whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen. Again, the Buddha's talking about keep your head out of the past and out of the future. Because even though, no matter how self-aggrandized we might start thinking about our past lives. And many people have fallen, oh, I've had so many past lives of suffering, and that's why I understand now. Or maybe in these past lives I was always a king or a queen or a center fielder for the Yankees, like I used to speculate for myself. And in the future, if I do enough chants, then I get to go to Buddhist heaven, where I'm going to be taken care of by Amitabha Buddha forever and ever and ever. Maybe that's true, but the Buddha never taught. I'm not denigrating it. It's just not something the Buddha taught. And as long as, and I believe that, I was a Pure Land Buddhist for a while, as soon as I learned that, and I'm greatly simplifying it just to make the point, that I just need to do this chant forever and ever and ever and ever, and the chant is going to deliver me to Buddhist heaven, to Amitabha Buddhist heaven. And so I got into the chant. I'm not going to get into it, right? And I'm not going to say it. And so I'm doing this chant. No, this is it. This is going to get me to where I want. I don't have to do anything else. I don't have to change my views. I don't really have to do anything. I don't have to be part of a sangha. I don't even have to affiliate with a sangha. All I have to do is this chant, because this is the magical chant. And so I started this chant. I started this chant. I did it for about 3 minutes, and I realized how ridiculous this is, because I'm not doing anything to develop my own understanding. What the thought that I had at the time was, if this chant really is Buddhism, I don't want anything to do with it, because it's the same as the religions that I abandoned, because they didn't teach me how to live right here, right now. They brought no understanding of who I was in relation to the life I was living. I wanted to learn, how do I live my life? I didn't want to learn how to live a life after I'm dead. What good is it? And that last thought wasn't even all that clear to me, but I just didn't understand my own consternation and disappointment with Christian, Buddhist, or any other religion. I mean, I spent a few years studying the Quran, seeing if maybe that'll work for me. And it wasn't until I came to what the Buddha actually taught that a different way of thinking or believing made any difference to me. And this made all the difference. Whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding of how it actually is, be regarded as, this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. The Buddha is referring to any time we find ourselves caught in a speculative self-establishment, caught in our imagination. And a clear key that we're imagining in existence is, if what we're imagining is not something I can't directly experience right here, right now. Because if it's not what I can experience right here, right now, it's a fabrication. It's imaginary. And so, the Buddha continues, it follows that any kind of feeling whatever, any kind of perception, any kind of determination, another word for fabrication, any kind of consciousness whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle. Gross means thinking of yourself in this physical form. Subtle means in an imaginary, non-physical form. whether in oneself or external, basically the same reference, whether inferior or superior, I'm no good, I'm better than everyone else, whether far or near, must, with right understanding of how it actually is, be regarded as, this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. The third time the Buddha's made reference to the key of the entire key of the Dhamma. Bhikkhus, when a noble follower who has heard the truth sees in this way, they find estrangement in form. I love the translation. I shouldn't say I love it because it sounds self-aggrandizing, is the use of the word estrangement. There's different interpretations, but that is perfect. Because what the Buddha is teaching us is that as we develop the Dhamma, this thing that we used to call self, which the Buddha teaches is not a self, we are now estranged from, which means, think of the word, it means all those views that I held in myself are now strange to me. I have no affiliation with them. I have no familiarity to them. I'm estranged from it. My view of myself is as strange as thinking of that I'm a Martian. It has no basis in reality. Let it go. They find estrangement in form. They find estrangement in feelings. All those feelings that I used to describe myself, they're strange now. I don't have an identity with them. They find estrangement in perception. They find estrangement in mental fabrications or determinations. They find estrangement in consciousness. Think about that. And so I can, and I think all of us, with a common peaceful mind, I can look back on the mind that I carried around for the first 35 years of my life, and it is strange to me. I have established estrangement with me. The way that I thought, the way that I treated people and myself is strange. I have no identification. I know it was me. It's part of my history. But it wasn't me. It wasn't the human being that I am. It's strange to me. It's such a perfect word. When they find estrangement, passion fades out. When this me that I've established in ignorance is strange to me, I'm no longer identifying with it, it simply fades away. The passion to maintain ignorance fades away. With the fading of that passion, they are liberated. That's the key to it. Recognizing the three marks of existence, recognizing that the five clinging aggregates are not self, passion diminishes, and with the fading of passion, we are liberated. When liberated, there is knowledge that they are liberated. How do we know we've reached the culmination of the path? We know it. We know it not from me saying it or believing that someone has saved us. We know it from our own direct experience. And that's why in each and every class, we talk about how we're developing the Dhamma right here, right now, how it feels, what it actually looks like, because that's what's important. To understand that we're actually incorporating a Buddha's Dhamma and we're practicing it correctly. That's what the framework of the Eightfold Path is for. They know that they are liberated. They understand. Birth is exhausted. The Buddha's not referring to a physical birth. In a very, very general way, he is, but it's not important to the Dhamma. Remember the context. In the context of the Dhamma, birth is exhausted, meaning that there's nothing left within me to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. I've exhausted the motivation of ignorance. Another way of saying that is that karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present moment mindfulness, that karma has ceased. I've eliminated all remnants of ignorance. They understand birth is exhausted. The integrated life has been lived. Usually the translations have where I say integrated life, they use holy life. And that really is an accurate description, except most people have a religious connotation to holy rather than a comprehensive or holistic. So I just changed it to a life well integrated with the Eightfold Path. The integrated life has been lived out. What can be done is done. There's nothing left to be done. The only thing we need to do is to awaken. What can be done is now done. Of this, there is no more beyond. There's nothing more. The Buddha is saying there's nothing more beyond human reality. And the only way to know it is to establish yourself in this reality. There's nothing beyond this. Despite all the magical and mystical connotations that are attached to Buddhism and religion in general, there's nothing beyond human awakening. as far as a human being is concerned. The Buddha never said there is nothing. He never made a declarative statement. He said, if you want to live peacefully, understand what it means to be a human being, and don't worry about nothing else, because as long as you're here, you'll be a human being. Now, during this discourse, the hearts and minds of the bhikkhus were liberated from craving, aversion, and deluded thinking. That last line, that's the end of the sutta. That last line is the Buddha's, is just the telling us that from the first sutta the Buddha gave, Khandana Awaken, this second sutta, from the understanding the three marks of existence as explained here, understanding the five clinging aggregates, the other four original monks awakened. And it just a remarkable sutta. When you think about the historical significance of these first two suttas, and even a third one, nobody knows, but for thousands and thousands, maybe millions of years, human beings have been living in ignorance. And in two suttas, 1 month apart, five more human beings awaken just by hearing the truth. And we're doing the same thing. I remember on retreat a few times, just teaching this to people that were really struggling, heard this one sutta, and almost like what happened originally, they really got it. I wouldn't say that they completely awakened, but they now understood what the Dhamma was about. And I hope all of you too do too after hearing this. So I think we'll go online first and see how you're all doing. I cannot read who this is. I'm sorry. I think I can tell everybody else. Sarah, is that you on the bottom? Oh, you're probably not the same on your screen, though.
I am here.
Ah, good. That was you. How are you, Sarah?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. I'm glad you joined us. What do you think of this morning's sutta?
I'm loving it. I'm taking notes here. I'm overwhelmed just because I couldn't focus on one thing to reiterate it back to you.
That's okay. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry?
No, I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
As you were talking about, you were reiterating, this is not mine, this is not me, this is not stuff. I don't know that I've experienced this in all the areas of my life, but I do know that I've experienced it in one area of my life, and that is exactly the way that it was. That if there was this realization, and it was through grounding myself in the present, that this is not me, this is not mine, not self. And it just that fast, there was no desire, there was no clinging, there was no craving, there was no wanting or the passion. It was just free. Mm-hmm. It was nice.
That's the right word, Sarah. Free. That's what liberation feels like. And if you experienced it in one aspect of your life, it's because you have developed it, which means you now own it, and it will start manifesting in other areas of your life, and you'll notice it. And that's not about grasping it or trying to fit it into certain areas of your life. It's simply a matter of continuing with the Dhamma, and you'll see it start spreading out into other areas of your life. It really is just that way.
And that was striking me that that these things are not something that's doing. That's what it's all about, right? Is to expose ourselves to the teachings and to hear those things, and they go in and they affect us and they change us from inside somehow. So that it's not that constant fighting and battling and wrestling.
Yep.
And so. Yeah, I really am taking refuge.
Great, that is it. Yeah, and I mean, you'll often hear me say that if we want to end up conflict in the world, we end conflict in our minds first, and that's just what you're describing. And even that first part of it isn't all that significant, except we all care about the world we live in. If we want to end conflict, we have to end it in our minds first, you know, because that's where all conflict resides. You know, there's no conflict outside of human beings' mind. It just manifests that way. Thank you. Becky, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm good, John.
Good to see you, almost.
This is just, you know, this is a core sutta. Everything that you need to know is in there. And it's just a matter of being able to do it. Having, like Sarah said, one experience of having that freedom and that refuge, just even if that experience only lasts for a few moments, you are changed. We go sometimes for a long time without having one of those experiences. And that's, you know, that's okay, as long as we keep going.
Yeah.
This sutta is it's a total teaching. Everything's in there.
Yeah, it is.
And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed reading it. I enjoyed picking out the parts of it that really spoke to me, and I'm happy to be here, and that's all I have.
Thank you. I'm happy you joined us. Mary, how are you?
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
This is a wonderful sutta. I agree with Becky. Everything is in here that you need. I think, you know, sometimes we talk about the importance of language and sometimes we overestimate the words, but in this case, I think it is important to look at words like estrangement. Like for any of us that are suffering, to be able to even consider that you can be estranged from that suffering at some point in the near future or after today's meditation. I mean, that's very uplifting and positive and something to continue to work for. And for those that have been doing this for a little while, we've experienced that estrangement many times, which often is just the noticing of what is no longer there, that the passion has subsided on a certain issue or something we cling to, or maybe the way we argue with others or whatever. You all notice one day, or maybe someone else notices one day, that you are estranged from a passion that you used to hang on to.
Yeah.
And then that direct experience that gives you the encouragement to keep going with your practice. And the other word is the integrated life, well lived. The idea of experiencing through the discipline and right effort of your practice, experiencing a full path off of the cushion in every little tiny aspect of your life. And when you start looking at it that way, you know, what's going on in the world today may be no different than the angst and anxiety and everything that was going on in your life.
Yep.
You know, before mid-March, and it's sort of a reckoning of suffering is suffered, and the sameness of suffering, and the application of the Eightfold Path to consistently address your experience or lack of estrangement with suffering. So these are great reminders and just very useful to keep your mind on the path and not on all the distractions of the world. And I don't mean that as a way to hide from what's going on in the world or as a way to not deal with it, not address it. Right? You'll have to take right action. Okay. And right view and you know, right speech, all of that. So that's still there. So there still is opportunity to do something about the difficulties in the world, but to not make them your suffering, I think, is the is the point of living the Eightfold Path. So I probably said a little more than I intended, but thank you, John.
Very well said, especially that last part, and another complete Dhamma teaching this morning. Thank you, Mary.
Yes. Thank you. Hi, everybody.
Karen, good morning.
Hi, good morning, everybody.
It's good to see you.
Good to see everybody, and thank you so much for all of your wisdom. I always feel a little overwhelmed, so I'm just going to listen. I feel very new at this, but I always get so much. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Karen, for joining us. And I will get back. There may be a small group of us coming up the end of July or early August. I'll talk about the design.
About fabulous.
That, yeah, we'll see. I'll let you know soon. Okay. Lorna, how are you this morning?
Hi, good morning, everybody. Mary, that was quite remarkable what you said. It was amazing. Anyway, just to add my little bit, I always appreciate a sutta that makes you look at yourself as really just a bunch of matter. You're not, it's just a bunch of stuff, and to look at your body and your mind, and that's really what we are. So I always appreciate a sutta that makes you look at that. I think that's important.
Yeah, it is.
And also, I think the sutta makes you realize that the difference between really what's happening in the world and what happens in your own mind. And those seem to get crossed in our minds, what's really happening and where our feelings are taking us. And I think this sutta sort of makes you really ponder on that and work that out a little bit. And I think that's good. Yeah. Again, like Mary, I like the word estrangement. The estrangement, as you described it and spoke about the word, I would also put in that it diminishes you. your feelings and understanding of the world, you don't put as much emphasis on it, and they just diminish.
Yep.
It takes a long time. But you really begin to understand and get a better understanding of the world, and not just get caught up in your feelings and thoughts.
Yeah.
You begin to see life really as it is. And when you're not seeing life as it is, it's really one of the five clinging aggregates that
always
is taking you out of reality.
Yeah.
And consequently, just to sum it up, you end up just dealing with life differently than if you didn't have your practice.
Oh, yeah.
Just on a moment-by-moment basis, the base that you work from in life shifts, and you just end up dealing with all aspects of life, good times, bad times, etc. You just deal with it differently than if you didn't have your practice. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Lauren. That was great. Just a comment to Mary. Mary, you really shouldn't outdo your teacher. That's not right. How are you, Josh?
Good morning, John. Good morning, everybody.
Good to see you.
It's kind of mind blowing. I haven't heard this before, and I'm kind of wheeling off what everybody else has said this morning. This concept that as I go through my day, and I'm looking around the way I react and behave, hate to put any percentage on it, but about 90% of the time, I'm sure I'm in some sort of illusion about what reality is based upon my five clinging aggregates and how it affects my mind and how I interpret reality. And but occasionally, when I realize, when I kind of am aware that it's all an illusion, and I try to think of what reality is in terms of it has nothing to do with me, sometimes it makes sense. I don't know, that's all. But it was a wonderful teaching, and I'm going to listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Josh. It's great. I think your contributions are so helpful because you're so honest about it. I'm not saying none of it. Yeah, you're the only honest one in our sangha. No. You're very straightforward. And I'm not picking on words or trying to play semantics with you, Josh, but it's more in keeping with the Dhamma to look at life and our view of life from an unawakened state as fabricated rather than illusion. Because what's occurring, I'm not going to go into it. When the baseball season starts again, that won't be an illusion. But when I get mad that they're only playing 60 games, that's the fabrication. That's what's causing suffering for me. By the way, I don't really care if it's 60 games or not. The things of the world are all real. It's our perceptions rooted in wrong view that creates the fabricated experience with reality. If we want to understand the reality, we develop Four Noble Truths. And then we see and understand the ever-changing nature of things, and we stop attaching ourselves to the world. And that's really what the sutta teaches. There's a lot there. It's another one of those all-encompassing teachings. So let's go around the room. We'll start with one of our teachers. Jen, it's good to see you again. Is this your first time back in a class?
It is, yes. Yeah.
Welcome back.
Oh, it's good to be back. This is a beautiful sutta. It really, especially just reading it or hearing it read, you know, getting it in through your eyes and through your ears, just works on you. Just pulls your mind back into your body. And
you don't mind if I just want to see your face again. I actually got that device I've been talking about, but it's not here. I can't use it yet.
So. Pulls your mind back into your body, and I forgot what I was going to say, but you know, when your mind unites in your body, you have no choice but to radically accept what's happening inside and outside. And the sooner you do that, the quicker you will experience peace, and you will skillfully move through a less than peaceful mind state and a less than peaceful, you know, environmental state. So yeah, it's really nice to be here.
Thank you, Jen. I don't know that I've ever heard it put that way, but it's perfect. We have, when we unite the mind and our body, we have no choice. And that's the essence of restraint, isn't it? It's not, we're not limiting ourselves, we're actually freeing ourselves by all the other choices that a self-referential ego self insists on maintaining. Instead of, it's just this, it's just life as life occurring. There is no other choice except to be that if we want to live an effective human life. So, thank you, we have no choice. Good morning,
interrupt for a second? I'm sorry.
Yes, no, please.
I couldn't hear Jen at all. Is it just me?
No, I'm using a new microphone. I guess it's that.
Okay. Yeah. No, can you hear us now?
Can you hear Tim?
Can you hear me?
Hello. Yes.
Can
but
you?
It's far away.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
it's distant.
Yeah, I'm using a new mic, and I guess new mic isn't working well. So
pass the mic around after some.
Well, yeah. All right, let me see what see if this helps. Rob, we'll work it out.
We'll try it out.
Speak loudly. Yell at your teacher.
Blow your mask.
Thank you, Karen.
I heard this one sentence. If feelings were self, we could wish them to be anything. That we could have them be any way we wished. And that it's just such a common thing that we do all the time. And we're actually being told to do this all
yep.
the time.
Encouraged constantly.
It's encouraged. Like, you should not feel this way.
Yep.
You should feel that way.
Yep.
So we're constantly putting this tension between our feelings and what we think they should be. Mm-hmm. And we're setting ourselves up for stress right then and there. And for some people, and for me too, for a long time, that was, you walk around your day with that stress.
Yeah.
Going on.
Yeah.
And
whether you recognize it or not,
yeah.
it's always there.
And it is very liberating to hear this and to realize that it's okay to feel what you feel.
Whatever it is, yeah.
You may not always want to act on it, but as far as feeling the feeling, that is it.
Yeah. Feeling feelings as they arise and pass away is the essence of a human life without needing them to be any different. That's where we are, and how we think about that is the and without any discrimination is the essence of human life or freedom. I remember the first talk I ever gave at AA. In AA, when you're expected at some point to get up and tell your story, and it's usually after 90 days. And so my sponsor at the time had me do it, and I was scared. It was a big meeting. It was an old Myersville Friday night meeting. It was about 120 people there. And I'm this, this skinny little 25-year-old, 90 days sober, still not, I don't even have my feet on the ground yet. I'm shivering and shaking. I mean, I was scared to death to speak in front of people. Imagine that. I was afraid to talk in front of people. And the first thing that came out of my mouth, I couldn't prepare anything because my head was still a jumble, but the first thing out of my mouth was, for 25 years, I tried everything I could to not feel anything, and today I'm so glad that I can feel. And the room looked at me a little bit like, you're crazy. But that really was how I, for the first time, I was 25 years old, and I hadn't felt anything real most of my life. And for the first time I could feel. It took me another 15 years to understand what feelings were about. But now that's the key to life, isn't it? I mean, I felt about hearing this baby got shot, and I feel about, baseball starting, just using those references again. They instill feelings in me, but that's all they are now. They're a reference to life as life unfolds, because I'm a human being who feels. But I don't have to judge those feelings as good or bad. I don't have to judge a person for making me feel this way, because nobody can make me feel any other way than what I'm feeling. It is a key to happiness. Thank you, Ron. Tim, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Hello, everybody. Hello, everybody online. Can you hear me? If not, hello.
I'm going to just stay asleep.
So the good, the bad, the ugly, right? so here I go. So I love how the Buddha uses logic in this sutta. He just basically asks those questions that just forces the monks to give into logic, is asking those questions about impermanence and feelings and fabrications and stuff. So I really like that. And I read your notes, John, and I have more notes on your notes because you really probe into it. But I really think that the key line for me in this sutta is when the Buddha states, with right understanding, how it actually is to be regarded. This is not mine.
Yep.
With the right understanding. And I don't know if that's synonymous with the right view.
It is.
Okay. So I think recognition and abandonment is not enough for me. I think that understanding has to be there, because just recognizing it, while it could be used as a band-aid, it will come back around again through dependent origination. And without that profound right view and understanding, that recognition and abandonment could actually work against you. I don't want to give examples, but that's kind of what I was getting at. And I have a kind of a thing that may be profound, maybe wrong, but is reconciliation with impermanence important?
Yes, but I will say that those terms are basically interchangeable with right view. And so recognition and abandonment within the context of the Dhamma. Recognition is framed by right view. In other words, we're not recognizing, I don't need to recognize the rust on my bumper to develop the Dhamma. But in the context of right view, that directs me to recognize the manifestations of my own ignorance.
Right.
So it includes, it's an aspect of right view.
Right view, you could recognize something as...
I don't mean to interrupt you, but if you're without right view, you're not practicing the Dhamma.
Exactly. Right.
So that's why the word recognition is a way of directing your right view towards recognizing fabrications.
Okay.
And it all settles in that right view. So it's a very important question.
What about the reconciliation with impermanence?
And so reconciliation is simply a word that describes the understanding that we're developing. We're reconciling all of our wrong views into now a right view. They're reconciled. And that's a word that as I restore the suttas, sometimes I have to choose a different word that's there that more accurately reflects what, in the context of the Buddha's Dhamma, what we're meaning here.
I got a couple more things.
Sure.
I don't take too much time. Thank you for clearing that up for me.
Thank you for questioning it.
So, and again, you know, you've warned me about paying too much attention to words. However, I can't help it.
Then don't.
Yeah. So with that in mind, that's why I ask these questions to the Sangha. You know, and this goes back to the understanding. And this ties into abandoning without understanding. If we ignore or disregard traumatic thoughts or feelings, that just reinforces and fortifies repression.
Let me say that again.
Okay. If we just ignore or disregard a traumatic thought or feeling from past events, couldn't that just reinforce a repressed state of mind?
What's the alternative? What else would you do with
understanding,
that?
Understanding that that thought or feeling that happened in the past is not important for today.
That's exactly
but
what we do.
But if we just simply say, no, I'm just not going to, I have this horrible feeling, I'm just going to...
That's not what we do, though, Jack.
I know.
We don't just do that. We don't just recognize a disturbing thought and say, oh, I don't want to think about it. Dhamma practice.
We need to, I think, for not so much for me, I will say for me sometimes, I think that needs to be stressed.
It's stressed in every single class. I'm not trying to shut you down. But what I'm saying is that it's practicing the Dhamma itself that resolves all of these issues. And so there's nothing left out of this as long as we're willing to wholeheartedly engage in it. The difficulty in seeing and saying, well, the Dhamma is not working here, is because we're not applying the Dhamma there. It's not that the Dhamma is not working. And so the Eightfold Path is a comprehensive path. It's up to us to decide, okay, this is how it applies. You know, there's a personal aspect of the Dhamma that has to be reconciled within the broader framework of the Dhamma.
Right.
And as soon as I start creating exceptions to the Dhamma, those are the things that we're clinging to as an exception. It's not that the Dhamma doesn't exclude anything, any aspect of human life.
Right, I feel it's that it's not feel, but the mind, understanding how the mind functions, okay, will try to protect itself, yes, by not fully embracing.
Yes, it will, and that's why
to
there's
get to those,
yes, that's why there's a an eightfold path.
Exactly.
That's the Buddha started out with just that problem. It's the nature of ignorance to ignore itself. Here's how you don't do that. That was the one thing that he considered after his awakening. How do I pierce the veil of ignorance? You think about it, a mind that's rooted in ignorance is also a deluded mind. How do you teach a deluded mind that it's deluded? And only from a direct approach within a framework. Here is an eightfold path to do it. Again, so if we take things that we say, well, it's an exception to the eightfold path, we will be unwilling to bring it into the eightfold path. But if we are actually practicing the eightfold path, excuse me, we will, as a consequence of our moment-by-moment life, bring things into the Dhamma. That's probably not the right way to say it. We'll simply start seeing things in relation to right view.
Yes, and then I thank you for tying all this together, because though this sutta, if really focusing on it, touches upon these things we're discussing, and I like it because it reinforces that incredible importance of integrating and developing the Eightfold Path from, yep, again, and it's introspective, I'm only speaking for myself. And finally, with that in mind, that if we don't do that, then our ignorance is perpetuated. And that, yeah, is really dependent origination and motion. If that, yeah, ignorance is perpetuated by not developing that right view,
yep,
and that Eightfold Path. So I really appreciate this sutta and this teaching and your notes too, by the way. There's, I mean, really, got the wheels going, got the cobwebs out. So,
and thank you, Tim, because you really drew out the essence of this by your questions, and your questions are they're very insightful, and they're also things that people get hung up on all the time, and to so many people, it's disappointing when they bring up, well, what about this and what about that, and the skillful answer is you'll find out, practice the Eightfold Path, but most people want a definitive answer from their teacher about a fabrication. And that's something that I learned from the Buddha, that not to get into that, because then I'm giving validity to something that's not real. You know, bring it to the Dhamma. Thank you. Good morning, David.
Well, John, I think the most impactful teaching line, and Ram touched on this, is that you don't have influence, you cannot manipulate the aggregates. And
will you say that once more? Well, I'm more interested in seeing your face than listening.
That the most impactful part of this sutta for me is the teaching that the Buddha gave about the inability, the impossible nature of controlling and influencing the aggregates.
Yep.
And that can only come from right view. You can struggle with it, you can succeed at it sometimes, you can become successful and think you've made it, but in the end, without right view, you will always succumb to the suffering that comes from trying to control those aggregates.
Always, yeah. Yep.
So it always seems like we fly through that one line because of the, you know, the question and response part, which is very impactful, but that one little line was really important to me,
yeah,
from the very first time I heard it, and I always like wait for that because that's the little teaching that you have to get. So thank you.
Yeah, and thank you, David. And in order to understand that, you have to develop the basics of the Dhamma, don't you? But then when you develop it, these things become rather obvious, and they're useful teachings. They're very impactful teachings because they change our minds. That's what we're here for. So thank you. Kevin, good to see you.
See you, John. Thank you. Thank you for this teaching. And thanks to the Sangha for all the wisdom that just flourishes from the teaching. And I really couldn't possibly add anything to it. Thank you so much. keeping us on the path.
Thank you thank you for making it necessary. What was that line? I want to thank you all for making this evening necessary. I said that. it really is. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard me say this, but this was a really great class. the longer my relationship deepens with the Buddha's Dhamma, for one thing, the more personal Siddhartha Gautama becomes to me, and I hope to you too. And this was a human being who went through a lot of the same things we all go through. And he figured it out, and then he spent the rest of his life teaching us how to do it. And you think about how this was the second teaching he ever gave, and how relevant and important it is to all of us here today to hear it. I was just so fortunate that his teachings are still here. We're going to, and please listen or come to Tuesday's class, because this is now, we learned what the self isn't. Tuesday's class teaches us the Buddhist teaching on what actually is a self. And it's remarkable. We'll finish, as we always do, with metta. Wait a minute. Let me get to the... There it is. So gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.